Tom and Curly Show. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. You can write to us at mynorthwest.com. You can text as well at 98973. Certainly do love to hear from you. One of you get a chance to be letter of the day. Yesterday, you didn't have Jacob. There is no one to take care of the teeny tiny lady. So Sean, for, I don't know why, we put him in charge of the horses and the teeny tiny. He placed a bag of rice on top of the jar. And he's like, look how she's having fun. She's running around in there. She couldn't breathe. She's coming in the way. Yeah, she's pounding on the glass. And Sean's like, I think she already found letter of the day. I said, no, she can't breathe. Time to get in the day.
I wasn't properly trained.
There's holes in the top of the jar. She breathes through those holes.
Never had a pet as a child, John.
You didn't sprinkle the flakes into her jar?
I don't know how to raise things. Except for the steaks.
Okay. Thanks, Sean.
She wasn't around for letter of the day either, remember?
Oh, no, she missed that. We didn't know where she was. Okay, so Rush Limbaugh, I think, announced about a year ago that he had cancer, that it was serious. He knew that, he said, that someday my time will come where I will not be able to do this show anymore. And he hated it. I remember when he was making those announcements and he talked about not being able to do the show. You liked the fact that he didn't, you liked what he had said about, I don't ever want to make the show about my pain? Is that what he said? Something similar to that, that I think you kind of commented on, Tom, mm-hmm. that you liked, right? That, well, it wasn't about his pain.
Yes, except, no, I think, though, I wish it was, because I think that would be a real, you know, he'd be doing us all a service. So he fancied himself as a kind of, you know, like a clown, like the fool would be like, smart and funny and entertaining. He led with this, I'm a salesman, I'm an entertainer, and I'm going to try to use those skills to turn, you know, people on to my view of the political world. But I thought it would be because he's such a good communicator. And of course, politically, I can't stand him, and I'm sure he wouldn't stand me if he knew who I was. The key here is that I think he could have done so much if he actually was willing to talk about what is it like. Right now, I feel his humanity more than ever because he died at the age of 70, which I'm 66. That's 4 years from now. That's the same age as my dad. That seems to me so young. I would be fascinated to hear how, because he's such a good communicator, what is it like to spend that last year of your life on planet Earth doing what you're doing and why he's doing what he's doing. I'm hoping that maybe someone will write a book, maybe his wife, maybe somebody close to him about what the last life in Limbaugh's life was like. Because I think that could really do a lot of people service, no matter where you are on the political spectrum.
I think he probably felt, I'm not doing the show for me, I'm doing the show for others, and I don't want to make it about me. And everybody that used to call his show, once he made the announcement that he had cancer, Rush, hi, I'm, calling, we're all praying for you. Thank you. And he'd kind of move right on in, right into it. But he does leave millions and millions, hundreds of millions of Americans that were huge fans of his, feeling a great loss today. Todd Herman, who has been, as Todd would say, the unbelievable honor to be the fill-in for Rush while Rush was ailing and battling cancer. And Todd Herman was on with Dory Monson earlier today. And, boy, it really hit him hard.
I'm still kind of processing it, to be honest. I kind of got a sense of things. You know, I mean, I've been filling in for Rush for almost 4 years. And I kind of had a sense of things early this week. And then this morning, some members of the EIB Inner Circle called me. And I learned, in fact, my wife was the first to tell me. They really wanted to make sure that the announcement was controlled. There were so many people who loved him. And then just being who he was, there were a lot of people who'd want to break this news. And they made sure that it was his beloved wife who did that.
Todd Herman, who does KTTH, and as he mentioned, he's been filling in for Rush. He talked about a personal story about
We
Rush.
Took a call. I don't know how we got on the topic. I was doing the show in New York. We took a call from somehow we're talking to Gold Star Dads. I think it was when there was that one Gold Star Dad who was going after Trump. And this guy called, and Dory, he said his son had been killed in Afghanistan. His son was serving over there. And in his effects, they found these really expensive cigars, like the sort that are kind of illegal to have in America. Mm-hmm. And they thought, where on earth did my son get these cigars? And so they opened up the box, and inside it there was a handwritten note from Rush Limbaugh. Because he would tour Afghanistan and Iraq. People didn't know this because he didn't promote it. And he would go see the guys. And he'd never wanted the publicity for this. And that man sent Rush his son's flag that had flown over the Capitol. And he'd seen it on TV. He saw it on Rush 24/7. He saw it behind Rush in his studio. And he mentioned this on the air. And I asked the man to, you know, describe, say his son's first and last name. And he did. And then during the call, one of the producers said, do not let him hang up. Do not let him hang up. And so I said, hey, just don't hang up. When we're done, I'm going to put you on hold. They put him on hold. And it's my understanding that someone told Rush that this guy was on the phone and Rush had to talk to him. He wanted to talk to the man because he'd gotten to know his son and they'd corresponded. And I learned later that wasn't an isolated incident.
Hmm. You know, I don't know how long Todd Herman has known Rush, but I guess he's in the inner circle of knowing those stories like that. As you might imagine, Tom, the animosity, the vitriol, just the evil and the hatred that comes out. I expected it, so I see it on the left, all the tweets and all the horrible things people are saying about him. So I thought, okay, do conservatives do the same thing? So I typed into the Googleating machine, prominent liberal lost death, and guess who comes up? Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I thought, okay, conservatives, horrible people that they are, they've got to hate her, and just the Twitter fear has to go nuts on her. I could find only one and I'd search for about 20 minutes. Somebody else might find him. Some congressman out of Georgia tweets out right away about the 30 million babies that had been aborted because Ruth Bader Ginsburg was okay with, you know, pro-choice. And then everybody kind of went after him. And then even other conservatives and other Republicans are like, yo, whoa, that is weak and horrible. And she is a servant, and she served on the Supreme Court. It took the guy to task, but it's interesting. It's always interesting. It's the person with the, you know, love lives here and we hate or whatever it is. And they're the ones that are most often go after conservatives that die. Scalia, that within minutes, people saying horrible things about Anthony Scalia. And same thing, Rush Limbaugh. I don't know why that is. I guess they just feel like, look, I can do it because he was such an awful man, and now here's my chance to say terrible things about him and you know, spit on his grave even before they can even dig the grave. Do you notice that? Does that sort of does that embarrass you as a liberal, Tom?
I don't. I reject your thesis that somehow liberals are worse than conservatives. I think that there's, you know, I don't think that one political stance is nastier than the other political stance. I'll just leave it at that.
Why don't I see evidence of conservatives tweeting when a liberal dies? Why don't we see them?
Maybe they do it while they're
alive.
Maybe
somebody's searching it right now. What's that?
Maybe they do it when the liberals are still alive. But that's, okay. That's neither. Yeah, of course. No,
it's a small thing. It's just happening. But even the Washington Post, the first paragraph of the Washington Post, that he was all about obstruction and anger. No, he wasn't. Listen, his show, he tried to do a lot of comedy, and people have been putting you know, oh, he said this, and he said this horrible thing. I tried to figure out how many hours. I think he's filled 27,000 hours of radio, and 27 or 25,000 hours of radio, because he's been on the air for 33 years, 5 days a week, right? I mean, so I figured out how many days. I did the math. That's what I came up with. Might be a different number. But I think people remember when he said this. Remember he said that. Remember the Fluke incident? And everybody went after him, tried to boycott him, get him thrown off the air because Sandra Fluke, he said, was a woman of considerably low morals. And he's hung in there and kept going. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, so here's – yeah, okay. I think that's fine and dandy. I'd rather focus on the personal component of Rush Limbaugh right now and the – professional entertainer component. As I was reading this long profile in the Washington Post, I kept thinking of you, So many of his bits sound like things that you have done on our show. So I want to ask you, I've never asked you this before. Have you modeled any of your radio persona on Rush Limbaugh?
No. I really? Always found okay. him to no. I always found him to be, and listen, what are you supposed to wait a certain amount of time to speak ill of the dead?
That's
the
yes,
guy. We would not have a job. Dory Monson would not have a job. What Rush Limbaugh did was created after the Fairness Act, which
yeah, doctrine very, was right, let go.
It's
yeah.
very Orwellian, the Fairness Doctrine. That once that went away, it opened it up where Rush Limbaugh could speak and yeah. have a microphone, and people would listen. 100 million people or more people listen to the guy. He set a standard by which people could use talk radio to express ideas that were not being heard on the mainstream or what he then termed as the drive-by media, so that the person would go, yeah, that's the way I feel. I'm not seeing that on TV. He was really the pioneer in that field. I didn't necessarily like the way so much of his stuff sort of it kind of came back to him. It kind of bothered me. He was sort of doing that for a while. Here's a clip. They're saying this about me. Here's a clip. They're talking about me. Here's another clip. They're talking about me. I always sort of found that to be kind of just, really? You don't get enough? But I wasn't an avid listener because I listened to other radio show hosts. But no, okay. I didn't follow.
But the wackiness, he talks about how he did imitations. You're a natural at picking up accents. He does, you know, song parodies, the way you do commercials and all that. I think a lot of, and so maybe it's just the osmosis of radio bits, because they said he learned a lot of the things that made him successful on the air when he became the superstar was all the stuff that he learned as a DJ doing spinning top 40 stuff. You know, you have to create characters. You're funny. You make, you know, and he says he was full of comic bombast that he would make a point. And then at one point there was an interview that says, do you really believe some of this outrageous nonsense, you know, that you spew? And he says, that's for you to figure out. And I just,
yeah, he's a provocateur.
There are a lot of things that remind
right?
me of you. Yeah.
Yeah. But he's a provocateur.
Provocateur. Yes.
People write, you're a big D-bag. You're a hard... And one lady writes me all the time, what an egotistical maniac. Oh, why is it always about your opinion? I got news for you, lady. For whatever reason, right or wrong, Bonneville pays me for my opinion and pays Tom for his opinion and Dory. This is news talk. It's the news slathered and then, unfortunately, sometimes it just... dripping with our opinion about the news, and that's what's happening. Is Rush Limbaugh one time said to, I forget who it was, the guy Robert Terrell from American Spectator, only in America could I be as successful as I am, considering what I had come from and who I am as a person. Only in America could I actually have the career that I have. And it's true. And so, Tom, we owe him, anybody doing talk radio owes Rush Limbaugh a debt of gratitude.
Well, then he has a lot to answer for.
Why that? Oh, really? Really?
So his shtick was winking grandiosity. I think that could be your slogan.
Stop trying to tie me to Rush Limbaugh, Tom.
I meant it as a compliment in terms of your entertainment. Yo, listen, you both have horrible political ideas. Does that make you feel more comfortable? But the entertainment component of it,
that's
okay.
better.
Fair enough. I'll leave you
finally,
be then.
One last cut from Todd's. This is Trump on Fox
Rush
News.
Is irreplaceable, unique. He had an audience that was massive, and you know he could do something, Bill, and he would get up in the show and would just talk. He wouldn't take phone calls where you know people would call in every 2 minutes, and that's sort of easy to do. He would just talk for 2 hours and 3 hours, just talk, and that's not an easy thing to do. And I once asked him, I said, "Do you study for the show?" And he said, actually, I studied very hard, which a little bit, Harris, that a little bit surprised me. But he was a fantastic man, a fantastic talent. And people, whether they loved him or not, they respected him. They really did.
I don't know about that.
Yeah. I heard Sean Hannity say that, if it wasn't for Rush, Sean Hannity and Donald Trump probably wouldn't have their career. And he did, yeah. You know, it was interesting. I hadn't really, paid that close attention to his career. I know that I think he took a real professional hit when the Tom and Curly show was on from 9 to noon because we were direct competitors.
But, you know, we did we took away part of his audience.
Yeah, sure we did.
We took females away from him. Do you remember
that's
that?
Right. It was
Talker
crazy.
Magazine. They brought it up. It was in this magazine that's all about talk radio. I'm sure everybody gets it. They had mentioned that the Tom and Curly show skew heavily female. They can't figure out why, and it took some of Rush's audience. But, you know, but we got that going for us.
The thing is, they did say that although he, like, seeded the ground, he was sort of maybe like the way people talk about the Republican Party now as being the fruition, or Reagan's presidency as being the fruition of what Barry Goldwater and William F. Buckley started in the 60s. In some ways, they say that he sort of seeded the ground for Fox News, for instance, with Roger Ailes took to a prominence, and the presidency of Donald Trump. But that he had sort of faded. He was being eclipsed in the last decade, that his height of power was in the 90s, and he was being a little eclipsed, even though he still had, I think, 13 million listeners a week or something. So he hadn't faded away, but he had lost his sort of preeminence. But my hunch is that Fox News wouldn't have been as successful if it hadn't been for what he did to the conservative talk landscape, or all talk landscape, for that matter.
Rush Limbaugh dead at the age of 70, succumbing
so young.
Was it lung cancer?
Lung cancer, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Tracy Taylor, look at the traffic for us on a Wednesday. All righty. Back. She's back after yesterday's segment, which I don't think has ever really ended. Muckleshoot Casino knows that she is the biggest and best in the Northwest, and that's why they want to stand right beside her, because Rachel Bell makes Muckleshoot Casino look like the biggest and best in the Northwest that it is. I started down that path. I tried to draw some kind of comparison, and then halfway through it backed up and just sort of wrapped it up in a nice little package.
You know Rush Limbaugh.
No, I'm not, Tom. Never claimed to be. Here she comes now. I said, here she comes now. Oh, God. No, darn it. Jacob, stop your music. I will play the music. Sorry about that, Arbell. That was a clunky beginning.
It was. It sure was. But you know what?
How you doing?
I don't
How
care.
Are you doing after yesterday's segment where you talked about the name for your cat for 6 minutes? Are you all right now?
I don't know. I've been talking about it for the last 24 hours, so I feel like I could still be going. It was like a pop-a-thon. I could talk about Poppy for 24 hours, raising money for the kids. How much are you going to sponsor me if I talk about Poppy for 24 hours, huh? I might have been a little bit out of my mind because some guy tweeted me and was like, that thing you said about the thing was so funny. And I was like, I don't even remember saying that. I have no idea what he's talking about. So I think it was a fever dream.
But you're on it today because I know you do want to get married someday, and you would like to have a great big wedding with a big poofy dress.
I would. It's in my hope chest right now. It's been in there since I was born in 1980, so it is a little poofier than modern times. But you know what? I'm dedicated to my hope chest dress. I think most people by now know, because of the pandemic, a lot of people have canceled their weddings. According to the Association of Bridal Consultants, 80% of people have either postponed or canceled their weddings. But for those who are going through with it and having these small ceremonies, they are shifting the money that they would have spent on things like a venue and catering to something else. And that's what I'm going to tell you about. So people, of course, are not renting big venues. They're not catering big events. A lot of women are downsizing the dresses that they're wearing. They don't want to have their hope chest poofy dress if there's going to be two people at the ceremony. And so people instead are putting all of this money into diamonds. I thought people would just save the money for the reception they're presumably going to have next year, or, you know, save it for the honeymoon, or just save it in general. But apparently a 1-carat stone before this year was the classic size of a diamond engagement ring. Now in the pandemic, people are opting for 2.5 carats, and even men are opting for diamond wedding bands.
Wow.
Diamonds.
Great.
Over and out. Over and out.
So rather than spending the money on the great big thing, you're just going to spend it on the rings. That's people find some happiness there instead of having friends come. Ugh.
Yeah, but I'm surprised. So they said the average wedding in 2019 cost $25,000, and I feel like almost every year I end up doing a story where I have to say the number that the weddings cost, and every year I have a cartoon reaction where my eyes pop out and I go auga and steam come out of my ear, and I can't believe how much money people spend. So I didn't realize that people, you know, dog-eared this amount and decided no matter what, we are spending this money, no matter what we have to do to spend it. I would have thought that if they weren't spending it on all of these things they had planned to, that they would just save it and not, you know, push it into another arena. But I guess, I mean, this is not the kind of friendship world that I live in, but I understand that a lot of people really like a big fat diamond. And I'm so ignorant that I don't know what a 1-carat diamond looks like or a 2.5 carat diamond.
Yeah. It's 1 carat. I remember watching... Remember Wheel of Fortune? This is my theory on the spending the money. Remember watching Wheel of Fortune? That they used to have it that when you had money left over, you could go shopping. And then the thing would open up and the person would have a certain amount of money they could buy. Yeah, I'll take this and that. And then Pat Sajak would be like, you have $1,000 left. And they go, I'll take the ceramic panther. And it was always like they don't really want this, but they got $1,000. What else? Yeah. You could put it in the bank account, and then you could spin, and then you get bankrupt, and then it goes away. So you'd rather convert it into a giant ceramic panther that I guess you'd put in your foyer. But so somebody's paying for the wedding. Let's assume it's not the kids. So it's the parents. So it's like, well, what are you going to do? You don't want people to come. We got the money. And then you just go ahead and you buy the rings. So that's my theory.
So usually, isn't the engagement ring the more expensive ring?
I think so.
So in that case, I'm just wondering if who's making out like a bandit in terms of jewelry? Because the guys, I don't know any guy who has a diamond in his wedding band, but if he does, are the women like getting bigger outlays? Or is it because the men normally don't do that? They end up spending money on men's jewelry, which seems like
it sounds like both.
Okay.
Yeah. In this article, they're saying that more men are opting for diamond bands.
Yeah, exactly.
From the Diamond Center?
Hi, it's Tom Shane. Did you have a
now
question?
His son has taken over, and I am not into it. I want to hear that familiar old monotone voice.
I'm Tom Shane.
I want to hear the voice that sounds like a man who's been sitting in a brown recliner for 16 years straight.
You've got a friend in the diamond business.
And he always sounds
he's
local.
By the way, big advertiser.
He does sound local.
He can hear us.
You want to know why he sounds local? Because it's such a cheesy commercial. Because it sounds kind of like the TV equivalent of like a local cable access channel, right? Like that's why.
That's why he's so successful.
Tom, I'm Tom Shane. Yeah, Tom, what did you spend on Paige's engagement ring?
She does not have an engagement ring. We only spent it on wedding bands, and they were relatively cheap. They were made to order. We found somebody who actually crafted our own specific original design. So we're very happy with them, and they are unique, but they are relatively inexpensive. I think we spent like maybe $350 on the ring or something. So
good for you. Okay.
And you, John?
I got my engagement ring my wedding ring for Paula at a pawn shop. I bought a Volkswagen, and then the guy goes, "And do you have a wedding ring?" And I said, "No, I don't have any money left over." And he goes, "Well, here, I got a bunch of them." And when you have to buy a something old, something new, something from a pawn shop, I mean, it doesn't even rhyme. And he takes out this case of these beaten up old rings. So sad that, like, I'm buying a crappy ring from somebody who had to pawn their wedding ring. Oy, oy.
But as long as you two, sort of appreciate it the same. I mean, I can imagine a lot of couples, that as long as they're in agreement, let's just do this. It's symbolic. Paula wasn't distraught, was she? I mean, she was in on the...
Oh, that was just the beginning of the pain. She thought that we started our relationship, we started our marriage with $9,000 in debt. Not a lot of mine, a lot of her. She thought my dad, who was very well off, was going to give us a check for 10 grand, right? That was the thing. Uh-huh. We're driving to the honeymoon, Tracy Taylor. We're driving to the Wiesbaden Hotel in Ouray, Colorado, and she opens the envelope from my father, and in the envelope is the check and the receipts that he is presenting in order to explain why he has deducted the check down to cover the amount that we now see on the check. And we got the receipt for the hotel, the airfare, the breakfast, which was not included at the hotel, and the rental car. And it all ended up $963, and you can spend the rest on the ceramic panther, if you like.
Right.
Sweet.
Yeah. A little shy at 10 grand. Just a little shy.
It's amazing that marriage didn't work out.
Wait a minute. You know what? Hold on. You know, Rachel Bell is still in the room. Let's not act like she's not here. Rachel?
Oh, that's right. Hi, Rachel.
I know. Rachel. Hi. I know. I'm just for once being quiet and listening and observing, and I hate it.
it's another fever dream for you. All right. Thanks, Arbell. You're the biggest expat in the Northwest.
She is.
Buc-ee's. Buc-ee's Auto Service Centers. You know, there's 16 of those locations. And being around, they got to check the date again on Buc-ee's. They've got to be around. I keep saying 50 years. It's got to be 51 now, right? At some point. You can't keep holding them in place. You can't be like a 48-year-old woman who keeps saying, oh, no, I'm 45 and holding. That's my mom's old joke. My mom's other joke was, show me a blonde, I'll show you an old lady. Which I can never quite get that one. But all her friends had that kind of fake blonde hair, Tom.
Mm-hmm. There may be some men, too. I'm not sure we have to throw all the women under the bus. They're 45,
that's my mom. So my
men.
Mom can't be a misogynist. It's my mom. All right. Keeping schools open year-round. This is an idea that people have been talking about for quite some time. It is another bold idea to help kids catch up. This is NPR has the story. And this year-round idea has been going for a while. What's National Public Radio's take on this one?
So do we have any audio?
We do not.
No.
Okay, good. So what they're looking at is they're saying, okay, so...
What do you mean, oh, good? You get to hear from us for 5 minutes?
Let's hear from
NPR.
I'm prepared to explain what NPR said, but I didn't want to step on NPR if we had had some preference. So
I will counter everything they say. Go
this
ahead.
Is, okay, this is... I'm not sure that this is meant to be political, but they're saying
it is.
So schools, our kids will have missed an entire, you know, school year within a month or two. And so how do you sort of catch up? The hunch is that this will have long lasting effects, not just for a year, not just for this particular year, that this might be impacting us and them for the next like 3 or 4 or 5 years because of all this catch up. So they say, so what can we do to catch up? And they've got a couple of possibilities. One is what they call acceleration academics, which basically just means summer school. And they tried out summer school. They did some pilot projects this past summer, and they seem to have worked. There's something called the National Summer School Initiative. They use certified teachers, and there's something also called Springbird Collaborative, which uses parents as coaches. Oakland Reach, they have staff and volunteers. And if it's kind of a programmatic approach that's independent of the schools themselves, they seem to have worked. The second thing they suggest, and this they say has more, this proves to be have a bigger, more positive impact than any kind of summer school or extended day care or after school stuff, is tutoring. That tutoring, they have absolutely positive effects if it's done right. It's not just anybody who tutors. They have these carefully trained tutors. They have to spend at least 60 sessions 3 to 5 days a week with no more than 4 students at a time per tutor, and it seems to have worked wonders, especially at the elementary school in terms of reading and to some degree in math. Then the third thing, John, I think you might find... We're running out of time.
I don't know if we're going to get to the third, but you can try to get it in the remaining amount of time, Tom.
Safer and more equitable schools. That there's more to school than just the education. It's all about the socialization of kids. And so we spend more money on mental health, counselors, accommodations, strong relationships with adults. If kids are having trouble, they would actually try to act as liaison to them for dealing with their housing and the like. There's also a reference I think you would not like, asking for different content in the classroom. The decolonization of school curricula, that I think might get political and controversial for you. But those are some of the ideas. What can we do in addition to opening the schools? These are some suggestions.
Well, could the national school average on tests get any lower? Hit a new low this year. So congratulations.
Is that right? Well, I'm not surprised, given that...
And that's from 2019. They don't have the 2020s yet.
Oh, they don't even
that's
have the 2020. Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, 2019 was pre-pandemic, so it must be plunging this year.
No, pre-lockdown.
Pre-pandemic.
Lockdown. We've had pandemics before. Never had this lockdown.
Not for 100
like
years.
Right, but we never had this lockdown. It's a lockdown, not pre-pandemic. It's lockdown. All right, Tracy Taylor.